What happened at 284 Green Street in Enfield in 1977? If you believe the made-for-TV movies or the major motion pictures, the place was a dangerous nightmare with either demonic or ghostly powers manifesting with bangs and noises, terrifying demonic entities, and extreme peril. If you believe in the Guy Lyon Playfair account as described in his book, This House is Haunted, that perhaps psychokinetic effects were taking place, and you would experience a variety of floating or thrown items and weird voices coming from children, horrible smells, teleportation, apportation, and a lengthy period of sporadic activity along these lines with no clear cause ever identified. But what if you ask skeptics? Let's find out now in part two of our look at the Enfield Poltergeist case.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters.
I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
This is part two of our look at one of the most famous poltergeist cases in modern history, the Enfield Haunting. In part one, we talked with primary investigator Guy Lyon Playfair. His partner in the investigation, Morris Groves, has since passed away. Let me remind you of the setting. It starts in council housing at 284 Green Street in Enfield, a suburb of London. The home is occupied by a single mother, Peggy Hodgson, a 47-year-old, recently divorced, and her children, Margaret, age 13, Janet, age 12, John, age 11, and Billy, age 7. In the book, This House is Haunted, pseudonyms are used, and Margaret's referred to as Rose. For most of the book, the weird activity centers on Janet and Margaret, and so there will be little talk of John or Billy in this episode. We discussed the kind of odd occurrences being reported in part one of this, but to briefly recap, the case began with late-night moving furniture, and frightened children alerting Peggy that something odd was happening. This led to the family fleeing the home, and eventually the police arrived. A policewoman reported seeing the furniture move. This incident leads to the press getting involved, and that in turn leads to the Society for Psychical Research, a.k.a. the SPR, getting involved. Eventually, an investigation led by Guy Lyon Playfair, who we heard in Part 1, and Morris Groves. Over the course of the investigation, a divide is present in the SPR as Playfair and Groves are open to believing in serious paranormal activity going on, and others in the SPR, most notably fellow researcher Anita Gregory, see the pair being duped by the children. Journalist Will Storr has a very enjoyable book, humbly titled Will Storr versus the Supernatural. I really liked it, but there's a section where Will looks into the Enfield case and gets an interview with Morris Groves and also with Janet, who's now an adult with children of her own. He tries to find out more about what went on with Anita Gregory and Morris. I'd like to read a couple of short excerpts. I invited Will onto Monster Talk, but as the book's a decade old and memory being what it is, he declined. But I'll put a link to the book in the show notes. In this first section, Will Storr is trying to get in touch with Anita Gregory, and he contacts someone at the SPR to see if they know how to contact her.
"Not unless you know a good medium," he said. "Mind you," he laughed, "you probably do by now, don't you?" "She's dead?" I said. "I'm afraid so." "Well, can I get hold of her thesis?" I asked. "Ha! No chance," said the man. "And I should warn you, if Morris Groves hears you mentioning her name, he'll take your head off." So I tracked down John Beloff, the professor who visited the house with Gregory. I wrote to him and requested his opinion. He said, "I am now 83 and my memory is not as good as it was. I do recall, however, that I did make one trip to Enfield and that I failed to witness any notable phenomena. Like Anita Gregory, I suspected that the two little girls involved were up to mischief." Then Beloff complains that Morris put Anita Gregory's PhD thesis out of bounds. I was stunned. Not only had Morris sued a journalist, he'd also taken action against one of his own fellow researchers. "Methinks he doth protest too much," says Dr. Mark when I tell him about my worry. "It's taking it to extremes, really, isn't it? How did he use a court to prove that it was true?" "I don't know," I say. "I'll have to find out what really happened."
Later, unable to find any copies of Gregory's dissertation, he decides to join the SPR and get into their archives.
So I decided to join the SPR. Perhaps, I thought, there might be something in the archives that could give me a clue as to what Anita had said that enraged Morris so much. Eventually, I discovered a series of letters to and from Gross and Gregory. Dated from the early 80s, they were published over several editions of the SPR's quarterly journal. I was thrilled. This was the argument that must have led to Morris's patience finally erupting. I read the letters with a mixture of triumph, fear, and fascination all boiling up in my blood. By the time I'd finished, that toxic slurry of emotions had fermented into pure liquid shock. It was devastating. The longer the polite but furious scrap went on, the more skeptical Anita became. And by the end, she'd become extremely skeptical. Over the course of the exchange, she says in print, in front of all of Morris's SPR colleagues, among them the most esteemed, paranormally curious minds in the world, that the evidence gathered at Enfield is questionable, greatly exaggerated, and ultimately pathetic. In one of the letters, Anita claims that she interviewed WPC Carolyn Heaps, the police officer who saw the chair move. Apparently, she told Gregory that she thought it was the children playing tricks. Anita also records a comment made to her by the neighbor, Peggy Nottingham, on 15th of January 1978. Mrs. Nottingham told me what was going on now was pure nonsense, and it was kept going by the investigators.
In this episode, we'll be hearing from three prominent skeptical investigators of the paranormal. Let's get started with Deborah Hyde. Deborah's a British skeptic, folklorist, cultural anthropologist, and the editor-in-chief of The Skeptic, the British magazine for skeptics who like their skeptical articles peppered with the longer spelling of aeroplane. We previously talked with Deborah in episode 108. We start out by talking about the occasion when Deborah met Janet on a TV show along with Guy Lyon Playfair.
Monster Dog.
It's quite rare for her to do anything public like that. It was a program called This Morning in the UK, and they wanted somebody who could provide, in principle, a kind of skeptic's approach to poltergeisty stuff. They knew that Janet was quite shy and nervous, and they didn't really want someone to kind of tackle her head on. They wanted somebody who could talk more about the principles of skepticism and why poltergeists probably don't exist.
When you listen to a lot of documentaries that feature Guy or Morris, historical interviews mm-hmm. that they've done as well, they talk about Janet being very intelligent and bright, but during the interviews that she's done, it seems like, as you say, she's very shy and kind of vague.
I spoke to her for a little while in the green room. I don't know her personally, but I liked her from meeting her and speaking to her. But the main thing I would say is that it seems apparent that she's unsuited to public speaking, and it's her choice. She's an adult, but I would think that it's probably perhaps that's a part of her life best left behind, because I don't think she really enjoyed the program. I don't think she enjoyed doing the program.
There's the new movie coming out called The Conjuring 2, mm-hmm. which is about Enfield. She's involved in the promotion of the film. I've already seen her included in some of the trailer interview, like the additional material that's probably going to be on the DVD, that kind of stuff. So,
well, this was, I have the feeling this was why she was involved on that particular interview on This Morning, because Guy Lyon Playfair was talking about selling the story of Enfield to be made into a dramatization, and it later on it was, and it was a good dramatization. Actually, I enjoyed watching it. So it seems that perhaps on the odd commercial event she'll come up, but she doesn't strike me as a person who's comfortable doing it.
No, she didn't seem comfortable in what I've seen, but.
Yeah, I think that's often the case with the fellow who's behind the Exorcist story and many others too. They just don't like her with Voyery from the Jeff the Talking Mongoose case as well. And she was just very loath to talk about that in her adult years. And you just wonder if that's related in any way to the possibility that they might have been hoaxing the phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way of knowing. And also, whatever was happening at the time, she was a child, so she was whatever happened, it just wasn't her fault. And I don't know what her memories are like.
Yeah,
because we know how changeable memories are. Really, anybody who was culpable at the time, I would have said was an adult at the time. I think that Guy Lyon Playfair and Morris Gross read an awful lot of stuff into that situation that they really shouldn't have. There were lots of people who disagreed with them at the time. There were people from the SBR. And in fact, this, for me, this is the methodological problem, was that anybody who disagreed wasn't welcome back in the house. So by definition, you were only going to get peculiar data. When you only had people around who believed, then, you know, that's just not good data gathering. Dr. John Beloff and Anita Gregory didn't think that, you know, that anything was really going on. Ray Allen, he was a ventriloquist from my childhood. I remember him on the television a lot. He thought that the gruff voice that Janet was experiencing was just ventriloquism. There were all sorts of people who just thought that the girls were playing up, including psychiatric professionals. They said, just go away, leave them alone, and it'll all stop.
I think if you have a look on YouTube, you can see lots of videos of, just regarding that demonic voice, you can see lots of videos of various training that you can do with your voice. With training, but to be able to mimic that kind of a growl and a demonic voice, it's really something that everyone can do.
Yeah, Guy Lyon Playfair really did seem to think that it was something that you would get into trouble with if you did it for a very long time, that it was impossible to do it. But no, you can practice. And the thing about the voice was that it was, Guy Lyon Playfair even pointed out that Bill had a habit of suddenly changing the topic, and that was a habit that Janet also had. And that whenever Bill joined in a sing song, Janet would drop out of it. Janet once slipped up and answered a question that was addressed to Bill in her own voice. So it's, you know, I mean, if you were there, what would you think on the balance of probability?
So that's the thing. So the skeptical point of view is, well, which is more likely, right? Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And we know, I guess this is the thing that happens in every poltergeist case, or it seems to be a part of every poltergeist case, is that part of one of the requirements is that usually there's a young person involved who's the focus. But almost always there seems to be some admitted hoaxing, or someone gets caught hoaxing. And then that kind of poisons it, right? I mean, it poisons it from a purely supernatural explanation, because if at least some portion of it is a kid faking it, why can't it all be? Or why isn't the majority of it?
Well, Janet was definitely caught moving the tape recorder. So Guy Lyon Playfair and Maurice Gross admitted that on some occasions the kids were pranking. So then in that case, it's up to a person to decide where the line is drawn. Were they faking all of it, or was it just these occasions? And I think it's a bit naive to just assume that it was just on the occasions that they were caught. When I spoke to Guy Lyon Playfair, he said that, do you really think that I could be fooled by a couple of children? But, you know, perhaps he knows a lot of compliant children. I certainly don't. L.C. Wright and Francis Griffiths fooled Sir Arthur Conan Doyle with the Cottingley Fairies.
Right.
You know, it's not
Fox sisters.
Yeah, it's not unlikely that bright kids could fool gullible adults. It's not unlikely at all. And you mentioned about young girls being involved. It's not just poltergeists. I mean, girls of a certain age, kids of a certain age, but especially girls, are involved in an awful lot of supernatural events. I mean, think about things like the Paris Family girls and Tituba in Salem. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, the Salem cases, the Pendle witches, you know, there's a young girl called Janet Davis who gave a lot of evidence against her own family, or the War Boys witches. Jane Throckmorton was a girl who suffered from fits. She probably was quite ill, but she accused her neighbor of being a witch. And there was this campaign against this woman for 3 years, and this young girl's sisters took it up as well. And they were all wandering around vomiting pins and having hysteria. And there were some very serious consequences, because Agnes Samuels and her husband and her daughter were executed for witchcraft a few years later. So it's only really in a modern context that you don't get really, really serious harms coming out of.
You've written an article, and we'll link to that for The Guardian, but could you give a brief summary of what you suspect as a skeptic was probably going on at Enfield?
Well,
Or is that too too?
No, no. I think it encapsulated my take on the whole matter would be that there were a couple of sort of bright, feisty girls, and their parents were divorced, which was very unusual in those times in that area. I'm the same age as Janet, so I kind of remember the social environment, and divorce was unusual. Her father had left. When he came to visit, he caused stress, so it wasn't a happy or a comfortable arrangement. And there were four kids, and they were bright and looking for attention. And then all of a sudden, these men turn up, and they're lovely and avuncular, and they turn up and give them lots of attention and lots of time. Maurice Gross had unfortunately lost his own daughter, also called Janet, in a motorcycle accident a few years prior. And he had been interested in the idea of life after death, and, you know, he joined the SPR and that kind of thing. So he was really, it's really sort of sad to think about it. He was looking for evidence of the supernatural and of life after death. And Guy Lyon Playfair had done work in Brazil on spirit and demon possession. So they already believed in an awful lot of things that we might regard as preposterous. And then they turned up, and these girls lapped up all of the attention, and that doesn't seem at all odd to me.
Also, I mean, that was the case in the Columbus Poltergeist, was there was a lot of emotional needs that were in some ways being addressed by the attention that came from the poltergeist activity.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense.
It does. Now, I guess one thing I would be remiss if I didn't remind our listeners is that any of these kinds of situations, it's important to look at each individual peculiar happening. Then you may find that there's a different cause. Like sometimes maybe it is a child tricking you, or sometimes maybe something, you know, a vibration knocked something down, or there doesn't have to be a massive overlapping supernatural explanation for everything.
Yeah.
And I think once you've accepted the supernatural explanation, then it's easy to lump everything into, oh, it's the poltergeist.
Yeah. And the other way around as well. I mean, there are some things that you can read in the book where you think, oh, okay, yeah, I just, you know, I can't say what happened there. Who knows? I can offer all sorts of ideas, but I just don't know, frankly. And that's the problem with bad data collection. Is that really people can't go back into it and offer useful theories, because you're just relying on bad information,
right?
People who believed in it, or only taking only taking testimony from people who saw things or whatever. So, you know, it's the method, it comes back to the methodology. The methodology has to be really, really good for anybody to make anything of anything.
It's so weird to me that they're making this film based on the Warrens research. So Dave Schrader did an interview with Playfair on Darkness Radio, and Playfair says that the Warrens didn't have anything to do. He said they did show up at one point, but that Ed was just interested in making money, and basically he told them to go away. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. It's very interesting. Yeah,
the other thing, Ed Warren thought that the children were the subject of demonic possession, didn't he?
Well, that's his thing.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, there's another thing that kind of occurs to me in relation to the Enfield poltergeist case, probably a lot of poltergeist cases, is that there are an awful lot of child protection issues that would apply now and kind of just didn't apply so much then. I mean, if you have vulnerable children who are showing behavioral difficulties and all of this kind of thing, would you want a load of people in there saying that they were possessed by demons or possessed by the spirits of the dead, or that they had been witches in a previous life? I just don't think you could get away with it the same now.
No.
Yeah, it's a good point.
It's one of the reasons I've always been bothered by Chip Coffey and his Children of the Paranormal approach to things, where kids, first of all, kids make up stuff. As a parent of three, they cannot be trusted. They cannot be trusted. So, I would say that the rules of evidence should apply to children just as much as they do to adults. And saying that you can talk to the dead is really not good enough proof, right? But if you have a low threshold for miracles and a low threshold for accepting the paranormal, then, oh yeah, it's a wonderful world full of mystery. It's just not one that holds up to any scientific scrutiny.
Yeah.
I think there's one extra thing, because this is one of my sort of fun areas, is Janet mentioned once that she'd suffered from this strange experience. And it sounds just like classic sleep paralysis. Sleep paralysis is responsible for so many weird paranormal experiences.
It is. You know, I was listening to another not related case recently, and one of the elements was the person said that in the night something crawled onto his chest and he could barely breathe. And I thought,
tagging.
But it's so funny because when I hear those stories, that even happens in the Amityville haunting. So, I mean, so it's like, it seems like the Amityville haunting was probably put together as a hoax, like as a money-making thing. But it's entirely possible that a real sleep paralysis event did happen, you know.
Yeah.
So that's anytime those stories happen, I'm much more inclined to think that could have really happened because I've experienced it myself and I've read a lot about it.
It's usually just one part of an overall picture, though. And
yeah, exactly. So
yeah.
So I don't know. It's like it's haunting becomes like a syndrome where you collect all the symptoms and call it a haunting. And are not able to like identify root causes for everything. But I think the risk is it's not just that you can't identify root causes, it's you stop looking once you've identified it as a haunting. That's, I think, the real risk.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you again for talking with us.
Yes, thank you, Deborah.
I really appreciate
it. Oh, you're very welcome. I've had a really good time and I'm very happy because I've been listening to the podcast for a long time, so it's fantastic to be on it.
Monster Dog.
Now let's hear from Chris French. Chris is a psychology researcher and a very prominent British skeptic who's done a lot of research into paranormal matters with a great deal of passion, tempered with scientific rigor. He's a professor at Goldsmiths University of London, and we last heard him discussing the psychology of demonic possession in episode 85. I start by asking him how he first came to hear of the Enfield case.
Monster Dog.
To be honest, I can't actually remember. Ever since I was young, I had an interest in the paranormal. It's no secret that I used to believe in a lot of this stuff, and I suspect that I probably heard about the Enfield case way back when I was a teenager. I have kind of read around the case considerably more. I think I've taken part in at least two or three documentaries about the Enfield case. And that's one of the interesting things, of course, that a case from way back in the 70s is still generating new documentaries. As you know, there's been a TV series in the UK. There's Conjuring 2 is loosely, very loosely, based on the Enfield case. So it's still one of those cases that is around. It's like Roswell. It's like a number of other cases that will never, ever disappear. Now, neither side is going to win in this debate. It will go on forever.
Now, you've been somewhat critical of Enfield in the media. You contributed to an article entitled, I know you don't write the titles, but Five Reasons Why Enfield Was a Hoax. And you sounded pretty confident that there's more reason to doubt this case's supernatural aspects than to believe in them. And why is that?
I think as you will be well aware, I didn't actually write the article. There were quotations from me in the article. And I think the tone of the article sounds much more definite than any kind of in-depth interview with me about the subject would have done. I think there are reasons to be dubious about the case. And on balance, I think there are enough of those reasons for it to be not unreasonable to say, I'm not convinced. I suspect it was a hoax. Of course, I can't know that. And I know that, you know, Guy Lyon Playfair will be pulling his hair out and getting very angry if he's listening to this. But there are a number of very good reasons to be somewhat sceptical about the case. I mean, for me, it is very, very important that the kids were actually caught cheating, and they've admitted as much. But again, there's the kind of standard fallback from the believer's side that, they were just kids, they got up to pranks, but some of the stuff couldn't be explained. And what that basically boils down to is the argument that if I can't think of an explanation for what happened, then it's certainly not the case that any little kids could have fooled me. And I think that's a rather questionable assumption. I mean, to state the obvious, we can all enjoy watching conjurers in action, but unless you actually know something about conjuring, you're probably not going to be able to figure out how they're doing it. If you can, then they're not very good conjurers. But it doesn't mean they're using paranormal powers. And there's often an assumption on the part of scientists and on the part of psychical investigators that if they can't think of an explanation, it must be paranormal. And I just think that basic assumption is wrong.
You know, that leads in perfectly to another question I have, which is, do you train in magic and deception as part of your work in researching the paranormal? Because I know Joe Nickell, James Randi, Ray Hyman, Richard Wiseman, they all have. And it makes me want to go out and buy a cape and a frilled shirt and a top hat so people will take me seriously about my investigations.
Well, I've got a very, very limited knowledge of conjuring. One of my colleagues at Goldsmiths, Gustav Kuhn, he, like Richard and like a number of other psychologists, he is a skilled conjurer. And so one of the kind of interesting areas for Goldsmith's research is the science of magic. We've had a number of events. We've got other events coming up where scientists and magicians will get together and do presentations, talk about various issues. And the whole psychology of magic is fascinating. It's a really kind of rapidly growing field. But what I do know about magic, I know enough to look at an effect and think, well, okay, I don't know how you're doing that, but I know, for example, there are many different ways to force a choice where people feel they're making a free choice of, say, a playing card, etc., etc. I might not know the details, I might not be able to do it myself, but I know that conjurers can do it, and they don't claim to be using paranormal powers. So it's not that I am a particularly knowledgeable person about the techniques of magic. I love magic. It's honest deception. But I know enough about it to not assume that just because I can't think of an explanation for something, that means it must be paranormal.
Do you have any thoughts on why poltergeist cases have continued throughout history if they're not paranormal? I'm thinking here about the mimetic nature of the phenomena. I'm wondering whether it's the activity of the phenomena that's spread virally, or if it's the categorization of the phenomena as poltergeist activity that's actually the viral part.
That's a very interesting question. I don't really have a very definitive answer for you. And I think it's quite interesting when we kind of talk about ghosts in general, that what that concept conjures up for most people is something that we've kind of taken from, certainly maybe more modern films have got a better grasp on the kind of wide variety of phenomena that can come under that umbrella of poltergeist activity. Whereas the concept of a ghost, certainly in kind of fiction up until recently, would be the kind of the apparition, the figure at the foot of the bed and so on. Now, in fact, ghostly encounters are quite rare of that kind, of a full-form apparition. We're typically talking about much milder phenomena, things like people going into a room and feeling a sense of presence, or a change in temperature, or hearing weird noises, stuff that's nowhere near as impressive and in your face as a full-form apparition, or even more so, the kind of poltergeist activity of objects flying around rooms and fires starting and all this really dramatic stuff. But my kind of rule of thumb quite often in the world of the paranormal is the more spectacular the case, the more likely it is that we're dealing with a deliberate hoax. There are lots of reasons why people might end up believing their house is haunted, which, you know, sincerely believing it, but the actual things they report are very, very mild and are open to other possible explanations. When you get these apparent cases of, as I say, objects flying around the room, fires starting, electrical equipment turning itself on and off and so on and so forth, it's much more likely that you're dealing with a deliberate hoax.
Now, the Society for Psychical Research has a long history of really serious investigations into allegedly paranormal activity. Have you worked with them at all, or do you have any thoughts about their methodology and their history?
I think they're really interesting. I mean, I'm a member of the Society for Psychical Research. I go to some of their events. I've presented at some of their events. And there's quite a wide range of opinions represented in there. Obviously, they tend not to be as skeptical as skeptical organizations. But there are, you know, I think they do some very good work. I mean, in the case of the Enfield poltergeist, Anita Gregory was not convinced at all by what she saw and concluded that it was basically the kids that were behind it. It was a hoax. Clearly, Guy Lyon, Playfair, and Maurice Gross did not share that opinion and felt they'd got very strong evidence to the contrary. But I mean, I think that there are serious people who want to try and do the best they can to produce good evidence. I mean, I think the members of the SPR typically, obviously, as I said, there's a very wide range of views, opinions, expertise, and so on within the organization. But by and large, those who are kind of serious about it, who take an academic interest, I think they are justified in saying that there is a serious issue here. There is enough suggestive evidence to justify taking these questions seriously and trying to get to the bottom of them, rather than a kind of knee-jerk skepticism that says, oh, well, it's all just obvious nonsense, we don't even need to pay any attention to it. And again, within the world of skeptics, there is a wide range of opinions, from those who just simply dismiss any paranormal claim without even bothering to look at the evidence, and those who take it a bit more seriously and maybe at the end come to the same conclusion that there is no compelling evidence for the existence of paranormal forces, but are at least willing to acknowledge that there is enough suggestive evidence to say it's a question that should be taken seriously.
It's certainly my favorite, or one of my favorite, sort of ghostly-related paranormal phenomena. It's the one I would most like to investigate hot, you know, to go in on a hot case and take a look, because it's the most dramatic, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. And you've always got this problem with historical cases, which is what Enfield now is. I mean, we can't go back there and investigate it live. It's gone. It's in the past. We can't recreate the conditions. We can't know. We can just speculate. And at the end of that, we'll judge, you know, we'll come to a conclusion of what we think is probably happening. That conclusion may be wrong, but that's all we can do. Until there is another similar case, and even in those cases, as you will well know, skeptics are not typically welcome to investigate them. It's far more likely that the pro-paranormal investigators will be welcomed onto the scene, and skeptics will be kept at bay, because usually the people involved actually have some vested interest in it being a genuinely paranormal phenomenon, and they're not that interested in boring old skeptics like me and you coming in and saying, oh no, it's just your central heating's making some peculiar noises, or whatever else it may be. And I have been involved with one or two ghost investigations, and the typical thing that certainly the amateur ghost investigation groups do is to always insist that they've exhausted all possible non-paranormal explanations for whatever strange phenomena are said to be occurring. And you realize quite quickly they just haven't. You can go and very often come up with a very plausible explanation. Sometimes you can actually prove that that's the explanation for what they're claiming. And really, certainly for those amateur groups, and again, I'm making a distinction there between the serious researchers who, through the decades, have been involved with, say, the SPR and so on, and the amateur groups. But the amateur groups, they are basically just looking for any kind of evidence, any anomaly whatsoever that they can present as proof to their minds of the paranormal.
Yeah, there's my colleague and yours, Sharon Hill, has written pretty academically, I guess is the right way to put it, about the lack of historical awareness of a lot of the modern ghost hunting groups, that they don't know about this rich, long history of really rigorous, or at least attempts at rigor, in their investigations of this phenomena. And it's kind of sad that all the modern ghost hunters seem to be getting their information from TV shows, which themselves are forms of entertainment, not documentaries, you know?
Exactly. And again, it's kind of very, very naive to treat those TV programs as being an objective, truthful investigation, because they're just not. You know, they fake stuff. I mean, I was involved in a TV series over here called Haunted Homes. And one of the aspects to that was that actually nobody involved in the program was actually prepared to fake anything, which meant that basically week after week, nothing much happened except text, which doesn't make for the most compelling TV, no matter how cleverly you try to edit it. And, you know, I think that's why we didn't get a third series, but,
sure.
It was, you know, whereas it's no secret that some of the big-name psychics involved on other famous programs of this sort were exposed as fraudsters, as hoaxers. They were making stuff up. Who'd have guessed, you know? So, yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, you have answered all the questions that I have prepared this morning. Is there anything else you'd like to say about Enfield?
No, as I say, I mean, I can see why it has become a classic case. There are so many different aspects to it, and a lot of that evidence that is presented, you know, would look superficially very convincing to lots of people. You know, people get very, very excited about the idea of police officers as witnesses, as if, you know, police officers or military people or pilots, if we're talking about UFOs, you know, all these kinds of things. The assumption that those people are somehow immune to the power of suggestion or to misperceptions of other kind, and it's just nonsense. It's just not true. We can show, and we have shown in our own research and the work of many other psychologists, that it's relatively easy in a minority, a sizable minority of people, to just simply by the power of suggestion get them to think they've seen things and heard things that just aren't actually there. So, you know, the fact that we can demonstrate that, I think it's important that skeptics actually try and produce evidence in favor of their counter-explanations wherever possible. And so, you know, rigorous demonstrations of the power of suggestion, I think, is much more compelling evidence than just saying, you know, just pulling these explanations out of the air. We've actually shown that these things are true. So, at the end of the day, as I say, we cannot, I mean, it'd be wrong to say, oh no, we can be 100% sure that there was no such thing as a poltergeist and there were no poltergeist activity at Enfield. We can't say that, but what we can do is form a judgment on the basis of the evidence as we see it, and the debate will continue.
So you just made me think of one more question. There's a facet of poltergeist cases, or at least the modern ones, that seems to be universal, which is that in virtually every modern poltergeist case that I've seen investigated by both skeptics and believers, there's been at least one or two incidents where they've caught someone cheating. Now, to skeptics, that sort of disqualifies the entire case. Would that be true for scientific research? If someone fudged the data a little bit, would that necessarily...
Oh, yeah. Now you're getting into a huge area here, which I'm quite happy to talk about.
Yeah.
Massive area. And it's one that's really been in the spotlight in the last few years, particularly in psychology, but I think the lessons apply to other scientific fields as well. And what we're talking about here is any scientist who actually deliberately just fakes data. Well, that's the worst sin you can commit in science. And so that just, you know, basically, to my mind, means, right, we can't trust anything that you've ever published. You know, you are...
Wakefield. Excuse me. Oh, sorry.
And that is... Now, but what I think is a far more insidious problem, which people are getting to grips with now, are beginning to appreciate, is the cases which I think affect a far larger proportion of scientists, and that is not fully appreciating how even kind of what might appear to be fairly trivial departures from best practice can actually lead to a very, very large number of spuriously significant results. And there's all kinds of things like the pressure to publish in high impact journals that have a very high rejection rate. So they're only interested in publishing new findings. They're not interested in publishing replications or negative results. And the thing is that those negative results are much more common than is generally appreciated. And so it's actually misrepresenting the state of research. You go to any, you know, top psychology journal and it will be full of positive, significant results. And you get the impression that these are robust, reliable, easily replicable effects. And often they're not. And we're beginning to appreciate why, because all of these, I won't, as I say, I could go on for about 4 hours and I'm tempted to, but I won't. But it's those minor little departures, things like, oh, well, I did the analysis of my results the way I said I was going to do it, and I didn't get the result. But then I realized if I transformed the data, the effect does come out. It doesn't seem to be the biggest crime in the world, but actually, you're giving yourself the benefit of the doubt in a number of different decision points, and really that stacks up in terms of inflating the chances that you'll come up with something that you can write up. And it's, as I say, you know, we're beginning to appreciate how serious a problem that is. It's not out-and-out fraud in the sense we'd typically understand it, but it's actually probably, possibly, arguably even more damaging to the scientific enterprise.
Yes, and I think the people who were anti-science are looking at these patterns and seeing it as the failure of science in general. But I suspect this will be statistical stuff that will shake out in the long run, but the long run might be 100 years, so.
Yeah. I mean, at least, I mean, science, yeah, the scientific method is the only approach that actually would try to take account of these human biases and eliminate them as far as that is possible.
Right. It's that self-correction, the fact that it finds mistakes and then recognizes them, tries to fix them, that really makes it different. It's just unsatisfactory to people who would like to have certainty, and certainty is not really a currency we trade in.
So. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much for your time, Chris. I really, really appreciate it. You're one of my heroes in this field, and it's just really great to talk to you.
That's very kind, and the feeling is mutual. Okay. Take care.
Monster Dog.
Joe Nickel may be the world's only full-time professional scientific and skeptical paranormal investigator. He's been on Monster Talk several times and is a tireless researcher into matters that touch the interests of our listeners. We'll put a lot of links to Joe's robust body of work in the show notes.
Monster Talk.
Do you recall when you first heard about the Enfield poltergeist case?
I don't really. It's been many, many years ago because it was in advance of my book, Entities. I gave a sort of a short summary in that book. So I've, you know, it's something I've been aware of for many years. And I know that Milburn Christopher, I'm trying to remember if it's in his book, ESP Seers and Psychics. But Milburn Christopher, the magician who was there for a brief time and, you know, and concluded that little Janet was a very, very bright and clever and tricky girl. Christopher was a big influence on me. His book that I mentioned is sort of a minor classic. And one of the few books, along with James Randi's books, that when I started being a paranormal investigator was available. There really wasn't a lot in the way of, you know, training seminars and so forth in those days. But Christopher had done something with that, and I think that might have been one of my intros, was reading wherever he published it, his account.
Yeah, I'd like to read his. Playfair writes about it briefly, about a couple of pages. I was just rereading it last night. And Playfair says, it almost seemed that the poltergeist was out to incriminate her, that being Janet, by producing third-rate phenomena in the presence of a first-rate observer.
It's pretty typical of Playfair, I think. You know, Playfair is an odd guy in my estimation. He's one of the most credulous people maybe in the history of the paranormal. He's just certainly among the very, very, very credulous people. He's typical of a type that has clearly started with some idea, an answer, if you will, a result, and then is working backwards to the evidence. that is clearly not the way to proceed, not the way I conduct my work, not the scientific approach, where you would go someplace and you would look at the evidence, you would sort out the best evidence from the worst evidence, and you would try to let the evidence lead you to a correct answer, like it or not. And what Playfair is doing is really just the opposite of that. It's you can see it everywhere. You come up with a reasonable explanation, a reasonable hypothesis, and he will just turn that upside down and find some explanation for how, well, it might look like that, but the entity is trying to trick us and make fools of us and so forth. And he is so willing to do that throughout his book that he loses pretty much all credibility in my eye.
You've also got some background as a magician. Does that impact how you would look at the things that were going on here?
It sure does. I think that I mentioned Milburn Christopher and I mentioned James Randi. The people who have gone after the paranormal from, you know, the 1960s to today, who've really been able to look at people doing tricks, say, specifically, have been magicians. And that's not to say that all magicians are skeptical or investigators, but of the best, I would put it this way, of the best investigators, the ones who seem to have been able to investigate human beings doing tricks, whether Uri Geller or James Heidrich or whomever, magicians have been the best of those. And it's not accidental that's so. Who knows deception? Who knows tricks? Who will get right in your face and do something so smooth that you will say, I watched every move. There's just no way he could have hid that in his hands. It was absolutely just, I witnessed it. And that's the person, kind of on the theory of the old saying, set a thief to catch a thief. Maybe you set a trickster to catch a trickster. I know that in my own work, my background as a magician has been absolutely invaluable. And not only in catching people and knowing, you know, specific tricks. You watch someone, say, when I caught a psychic medium at Camp Chesterfield doing a billet reading trick, and I know exactly, because I know several ways of doing that trick, and I was on to him in just in no time at all as to exactly which method he was doing, and I set a trap for him, and he fell into it, and I know that he was doing a particular trick. It's not just that, but the magician's mind is such that we can, you know, ideally, the magician also sees how people are fooled by illusions, even if they are inadvertent. And you know me, I've talked before about things like footsteps on the stairs at McKinsey House and how they were really coming from a real staircase next door, and it was an illusion. It wasn't intentional at all. Or how people will see a lake monster that in fact is three or four otters swimming in a line. And there are a number of these, and I think the magician is more inclined to pick those out because he's trained to see illusions and to know how illusions work and how, yes, you saw just what you said you did, but here's the rest of that story.
Sure. Now, in your career, have you had much interaction with the Society for Psychical Research?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I
find them an interesting group because they seem to be a mixture of people who strongly believe and who are strongly skeptical. And I just wonder what those meetings are like. But I know that at some point during the investigation Playfair and Gross were at odds with other SPR investigators who felt that they were being duped and had gotten too close to the family. I didn't know if that...
Right. The SPR has done some debunking of people like Hans Holzer and others. I mean, they're not just credulous types who always fall into line. But I've not worked with them or anything. I've the nature of my work, I guess, is that I probably just, that wouldn't happen. Very few people, get into a house where something like that is going on in its active phase. Milburn Christopher did at Enfield, but you remember Randy was rebuffed, in the Tina Resch case by Tina Resch's parents in that poltergeist case. And one could just go down the list at the times that skeptics have not been welcomed in for one reason or another.
At one point, Playfair wrote, "It was becoming apparent that paranormal events only took place in the presence of people who believed them to be possible." But it seems when he says that, he's not implying that people who are skeptical interpret the evidence differently. Instead, it seems like he's saying that these skeptics are preventing the paranormal from happening. And I've heard that kind of claim leveled at Randy, some people calling him an anti-psychic.
Well, that's absolutely been hurled at Randy many, many, many times. That, as soon as the magician comes in, and it's not just Randy. I mean, this is well established throughout the world of the paranormal, particularly where you have somebody performing, somebody doing something, not necessarily flying saucer cases or ghosts, but where you have some psychic or someone with a purported ability. Because remember Dr. Rhine's famous ESP experiments at Duke University, and they had people who were occasionally were really getting just incredible scores on the guessing as to the cards, what the cards were, as they, recorded a run of ESP card tests. And there are instances there that when skeptics came in, particularly one instance I remember where a magician came in, and this phenomenal guy was scoring really phenomenally high in ESP, but it turns out was being allowed to handle and shuffle the cards himself, a no-no to anyone with a modicum of magic knowledge. And a magician came in and, of course, sort of stopped that and observed and so forth. And, of course, the phenomena dropped to chance, as I recall, pretty close to what actually happened there. So This is very common, that there's a whole body of literature about this kind of effect of the skeptic causing trouble and people only being able to do things under favorable conditions, where it's in the case of Enfield, the voice that ultimately was traced to sort of amateur ventriloquism by Janet, the voice wouldn't speak unless the girls were allowed to be in the room alone and the door closed. What does that tell us?
Yeah, the book is full of cases where they leave recording equipment or photography equipment lying about the house trying to catch things, because the things just won't happen when people are watching.
It's really one of what I would call several markers that, if you step back and look at the Enfield case, and I tend to look at it as a magician, that is, I'm aware that a kind of magic trickery is going on where somebody's performing something and doesn't want the mechanism to be seen, i.e. that maybe I've secreted something in my hand, and when you're looking slightly the other way, I flip it from behind my back, and then I say, look, and it appears to be floating in the air or something. Simple tricks. But there are markers, and I would just mention a few of those. For example, that that indicate deception or that favor the hypothesis that this is nothing more than the tricks of young girls. And one marker would be the fact that the phenomena tend to center around Janet, also occasionally around Peggy. So when Janet couldn't have done it, maybe Peggy did. So that's one marker, that fact that we have things happening when Janet's available and at the center of things and causing things. A second one would be that the phenomenon doesn't want to be seen, just as we just talked about. Another example of that in the world of the paranormal would be the crop circle phenomenon. And I did a study that showed that the crop circles didn't seem to want to be made and were made mostly at night in distant fields. A third marker with the Enfield case would be that the various mischief and the phenomena seem to be of a type a child could and would do, kind of in the nature of mischief and pranks and play acting. Another one, I'm not counting so much, but a fourth, say, maybe, and there's actual evidence against the genuineness of the phenomena. For example, the levitation photos clearly show not levitation, but Janet using the bed as a trampoline and jumping in the air. And you can see this I've done a sketch showing that. The expert opinions, another marker would be the expert opinions of a ventriloquist and a magician in the case, and they were sure that that it was ventriloquism and magic tricks. Another marker would be tests. When the girls were tested by separating them, when they were put in separate houses, then there was phenomenon at each house with Janet and Peggy. Well, that's pretty revealing. And further to that point, when both girls were absent, nothing happened. So that's a pretty strong marker that we can use. And then, of course, ultimately the girls confessed, and then, of course, Playfair and Gross got them to retract their confession. But when you look at all those are more or less separate markers to look at the Enfield case, however many I listed there, and that really suggest and corroborate each other so that you have a number of factors, any one of which you might want to argue against, but the more of these factors, these markers you have, the more you have the characteristics of what I've named and Robert Bartholomew has picked up in our book and used it, our book, American Hauntings, what I call the poltergeist faking syndrome. And that is where someone mimics being a poltergeist, play acts and does the tricks and things necessary. And you can show it in case after case after case. And Enfield is just a fairly typical good example of that.
It is interesting to me that Playfair makes makes much ado about the fact that Janet didn't know much about the paranormal, but explicitly mentions that other kids at the school were telling her about funny things that had happened that sounded like poltergeist activity, and that there were other famous poltergeist cases in the news around the same time. So she's certainly not working in a vacuum.
Right, and I have this notion that, you know, poltergeists could be independently invented in remote rural areas of Europe, for example, without necessarily hearing about other cases, because unless you actually come out with the word poltergeist or some particular parapsychological hypothesis of the same or something, all that's needed is for a kid to really anywhere, anytime, 16th century, 18th, pick your time and place. All you need is a kid to act up. We have examples that look just like this. The kid acts up, and then
but secretly. And when the family says, you know, little Jimmy, did you do that? And the kid denies it. And pretty soon the kid finds that the parents, say, or the adults in the room, are very, very credulous, very, very gullible, and may themselves attribute something to demons or mystical forces or mischievous spirits or something. And they're doing the work. The kid is just acting up, and the grown-ups are putting a dogma on it, as was done at Enfield. You know, there was some were claiming it's poltergeist phenomena, but others suggested demonic possession. You could maybe put several other labels on it. And so there's not a very good argument to say that they were totally unaware of poltergeist phenomena, and yet here it was happening. I just find that really pretty silly. And I find Playfair in general just very silly. Playfair seems to, as I said, start with the answer, work backwards to the evidence, to be engaging all the time in confirmation bias. He's got this belief, and evidence just doesn't seem to support it, so he says, well, but what if, and maybe there's this, and here's something you can't explain, no matter how many other things you have explained, and he's always doing that. And when he does that, he's really engaging in the classic argument from ignorance, where he's trying to say again and again, well, we don't know what could cause this. Doesn't appear to be innocent little Janet, and probably isn't this or this, so it must be something paranormal. And he's just engaging in the typical argument from ignorance, which I've argued is the basis for the paranormal. This is how the paranormal is promoted again and again, all the areas of the paranormal, based on basically negative evidence. They don't have positive evidence for anything. They just have this, we don't know, therefore, which is illogical.
And pervasive.
Yeah.
Wow, that's great. This is exactly what I was looking for. Is there anything else you want to add about Enfield?
Well, maybe not particularly. We've covered a lot of my pet peeves, and I just think we need to get a look at it and apply to the case the principle of Occam's razor. This is a good case, I think, to apply that to, that we're basically developing two hypotheses, one that it's a case of some kind of mystical invisible force, such as a poltergeist or a demon, something of the sort, or it can be explained as normal phenomena, and i.e. the trickery of schoolgirls. And I would argue that, first of all, the simplest hypothesis, the one, because the second one I mentioned does not depend on the assumption that there really are poltergeists or demons. So when you say that Occam's razor prefers the hypothesis with the fewest assumptions, that would be that, well, schoolgirls can do tricks, and tricks could theoretically explain everything going on there. And then I would say secondarily that we have basically a lot of corroborative evidence. So we know from the indicators, the markers I gave earlier, and the confession, that that is the hypothesis. So it is clearly what I use the terminology, I advanced this years ago in my doctoral dissertation. This is the preferred hypothesis. And you can show logically and reasonably that it is a preferred hypothesis. You may not like it, and Playfair doesn't, but you can't just say, well, I don't like your hypothesis, or it has a minor little, you know, I'm quibbling over it or something. You have to either show, to get rid of it, you have to show that there is an absolutely fatal problem with the hypothesis, and nobody has ever done that with Enfield, and Playfair can't do it. Or you show that there is a better hypothesis. You must replace the hypothesis you don't like with the better one. And again, we pretty much have the best one that can be found, and that is that it's the tricks of schoolgirls. So from the basis of the scientific investigator, I would say that's it. The poltergeist case is vanquished, and science has won again. Playfair is gasping at straws and is a desperate man refusing to give up.
I think he's a fan of you, too. What?
Yes, he doesn't like me. He said he was quoted as saying, you know, nickel can piss off, I think was the exact words. And I wrote a response back and said that I thought Playfair wasn't playing fair. But, you know, name-calling is not the point. I'm only mentioning kind of problems about him, not in an ad hominem way, in that I'm trying to use an argument against him to somehow make my points. I don't need him at all to make the points I've made and to point out the markers that I've pointed out. I don't need him at all. I don't have to say, oh, he's a bad person, therefore, you know, this isn't true. No, it's not an ad hominem attack in logic at all. I'm just, the negative things I say about him are by way of answering, why are we still bothering with this case? And he's responsible. He's a very gullible man, and I don't say that to be mean-spirited. I just say that as, you know, just as, you know, factually as I would say that, you know, that piece of fruit is a mandarin orange.
So I appreciate you joining us again. And as always, if you find any monsters, please give us a call. But otherwise, we'll reach out to you again for sure about some other things that are of interest to our listeners.
Yeah, thanks for thinking of me. And I have to say, you know, I'm not very good at finding monsters. I'll say this in a moment in which I'm not as, you know, as modest as I usually am. And you know that I'm one of the most modest people you've ever met.
I've seen your modesty awards many times.
It's huge. It's huge. But, and I don't like to talk about it. But in a immodest moment, I would say that while I'm not good at finding monsters, I'm pretty good in getting better at finding monster lookalikes. So I have some monster lookalikes we haven't talked about, and so sometime, you know, the Bigfoot Bear and others. So we can talk again.
We will have you back for sure.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to the second part of our coverage of the Enfield Poltergeist case on Monster Talk, the science show about monsters.
I'm Karen Stolzner.
And I'm Blake Smith.
Hopefully you now have a good understanding of the skeptical position on Enfield and the believer perspective as well. This is just a tiny sample of the extensive back and forth arguments surrounding this case, but there are a lot of links in the show notes. This two-part coverage started out with me expecting it to be about the Warrens, but then I felt that I really needed to tell as much of the true story of what went on there as was possible, and hopefully as fairly as possible. The Warrens effectively had nothing to do with the Enfield case. In the time since I started working on these episodes, The Conjuring 2 has gone from being a coming-soon feature to a available-on-DVD film. As a horror fan, I really enjoyed the film. As a fan of actual paranormal research cases, I hated how they changed the story. It's a fun film, and at the same time, I can't recommend it unreservedly because of how they take out Playfair and diminish the work of Morris Gross. Consider it a work of the purest fiction, and perhaps you can enjoy it. It does have some good scares in it, not the least of which is the producer's continued effort to apparently canonize Ed Warren. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed on Monster Talk are those of my respective guests themselves, or myself, or my co-host, depending on who's talking, and may not represent the official views of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation.
If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. By the way, I believe all three of today's guests are featured in Karen's latest book, Would You Believe It?, links to which you can find on Amazon.com and in the show notes of our previous episode and in Karen's biography on our website. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. As always, thank you so much for listening.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.
As soon as you start lumping all the phenomena together, then you have a haunting. But if you look at each individual phenomena...
Look at the cases.
Phenomena. Yeah. You know what? I got to stop.
Phenomenon.
Because if you look at the phenomenon, anyway, if you look at them, if you look at each individual peculiar happening, there, I fixed it.